Welcome to the Zimcast, a program dedicated to bringing you what's new in agricultural marketing. The Zimcast is the official podcast of AgWired and hosted by Chuck and Cindy Zimmerman.
Hello and welcome to the Zimcast. I'm Chuck Zimmerman. Before we get to this week's interview in this program, I want to thank our sponsors. That includes Novus International, a leader in animal health and nutrition for the poultry, beef, aqua, dairy, and pork markets. And also Leica Geosystems. When it has to be right, look to agguidance.com. In this week's program, we're going to meet Mike Smith. He works for Food Chain Communications, and we're going to talk a little bit about truth in food. In fact, truthinfood.com is the website. So let's learn a little bit more about what Mike and the folks in his company are doing to try to spread a little bit of truth about our food supply. Mike, for people who don't know you, why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself and what you do?
Well, I consider myself an old farm editor, and I had the bad foresight to come of age and want to return to the family farm in the early 80s. So instead of doing that, I decided to get into ag publishing and have been doing that ever since. Now I'm associated with a communication company called Food Chain Communications here in the Kansas City area. That was started in 2007 by Kevin Murphy, who's also come out of ag publishing, and Kevin's vision was to create a communication company that would help everyone up and down the food chain communicate better with one another, to understand better what we all do to get food on people's tables every day.
So about how long have you been doing this now?
I have been in ag publishing all my career, since the early 80s. And we have, like I said, I've worked with Kevin since he started Food Chain Communications in 2007. And just about a year to the day, your timing's pretty good, we started a new initiative called Truth in Food. And I've been heavily involved in that since.
Well, I got to say, I love the name because, to start with, I love food. And as most of us in agricultural communications would like the consuming public out there to know the truth, because there's certainly a lot of misinformation that floats around these days, as we all know. So tell me a little bit about this Truth in Food. It's a pretty self-explanatory name, but you've got a website, truthinfood.com, and what are you trying to accomplish there? You know, what are we going to find when we go to the website, and how's that going?
Well, I like that you latched onto that word truth, because that was our goal as well. When Kevin and I sort of had the brainchild for this project, that would be an online publication that would kind of look at food and some of the issues surrounding food from a little bit different perspective. We wanted to kind of apply some of the scholarship, some of the sometimes obtuse and arcane scholarship that's coming from some of the critics of modern farming and food production. But then we also wanted to try to look at that through sort of the natural ability of the farmer, that I know you understand, having worked with farmers for years yourself, but the natural ability of farmers seem to have to kind of cut through the manure and get right to the down to the simple truth. So we wanted to look at some of the issues that sometimes may not make a lot of sense to your audience and mine. They seem so odd sometimes, but I tell the story often that back the last time we had a public funding crisis like we're having right now in the 80s, that the land grant institutions were running around trying to figure out ways to save money. And I remember a professor of animal science who proposed that the land grant universities completely get rid of their humanities departments. He said, "Ag students don't need that stuff. Let's just cut them. We can save the dollars." And there was serious consideration of that. Of course, we never did that, but there was serious consideration based on that idea that ag students need to know science, they need to know agriculture, but they don't need to know things like philosophy and psychology and sociology. And I think, turns out, we really, as ag students, as practitioners of agriculture today, we do need to know that stuff. We need it. We need to understand it, because that's where criticism of our system is coming from right now. It's no accident to me, for example, that Michael Pollan, the most visible critic of modern agriculture, is not a scientist. He's not a nutritionist. He's a creative writer. He's a professor of journalism at Berkeley. And we see this often. We see that food is one of the most discussed topics in the news these days, for example. But if you peel back some of the overt criticism, what you find are some more fundamental questions involving things like the sociology and the politics and the anthropology, the cultural questions, the psychology, even the morality of what we do as farmers to feed the world. So that's sort of a long-winded explanation of how we're defining truth when we talk of truth in food, but that was our goal, was to get at some of these underlying issues that too often in agriculture we try to answer with questions of science, with answers of science and answers of economics. And we just never quite, the two extremes never quite meet in the middle to have a meaningful discussion over what it all means.
Well, well said. I mean, one of the things that I think I first saw, and as I understand it, it's the most, if you go to truthinfood.com, one of the articles that you've written that probably has gotten the most attention was one about titled "The 10 Reasons They Hate You So," the you being farmers. And so going through those, I just thought it was very interesting. Number one, they hate you because you trust in science. And like you said, so much of what we see seems to be based more on an emotion, a perception, and you know, don't bother me with the science part of it because it interferes with that, you know.
Yes, that's right. That's exactly right. And what I say is that is our traditional way of handling these criticisms, is we say, look, we have the science on our side. Perfect example of that is this debate over the use of antibiotics in food animal production. I think that's a perfect example. We have the science on our side. It's virtually unquestionable that the science shows there's no significant risk to public health from doing that. Yet we are on the verge of losing that fight for this reason, because we have not yet addressed the other underlying issues that are leading to this. I said in that story you mentioned the 10 reasons they hate you, but I've said this often before, is that we in agriculture address our critics often by saying, well, you know, the problem is all our consumers are three generations from the farm now. They just don't understand farming. They don't understand the science of farming. They don't understand the economics of farming. They don't understand the physical constraints of farming. And what I say is, people on our side of the fence equally do not understand why the critics are criticizing what we do in production agriculture. We don't understand their underlying, philosophical, sociological, political, and even ethical and moral objections to what we do. Until we begin to understand those in the same language and the same thinking that those critics bring to that debate, we're never going to effectively address that criticism.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And understanding is like step one. Of course, you have to kind of do something with that understanding too. But it seems to me like a lot of what we're seeing is, and it's not just ag alone, but people in our society today are constantly looking for something to blame for just about everything that happens, from the weather to my daughter at the dinner table yesterday was talking about an article she had read that that young girls are reaching puberty at an earlier age.
I saw that.
You know, and tending to blame that possibly on those darn hormones you mentioned that are used to feed animals for
right.
food today. And so, you know, that just was like a random comment that came up. Can you imagine that in places, like you said, all across America, where people don't have the connection and understanding or even the science, of course, to sort of balance that that notion, because that's all it was. I don't think there was any science to back it up, but it obviously was catching on.
Yeah, right. And see, now I think you're beginning yourself to do exactly what we set our goal to do with Truth and Food, and you're saying, okay, let's try to look past the science that says any hormone that may remain in beef from the use of implants is a fraction of what you get from eating soy products, for example.
Right.
And let's look at why people feel the need to be afraid of that in the first place. You know, another story we did on Truth and Food called "Tell Us a Tale, Katie Ann." This was about the CBS News, Katie Couric's series on use of antibiotics in food. And what we did was was sort of deconstruct that news report from the perspective of how it resembled some of the old fables and fairy tales in our history, and how those tales not only were constructed, but what the purpose of them was. And the purpose was to help people try to understand why tragedies around them occur. Why children die, for example. Children die from food every day. They die either because they don't have enough or because, unfortunately, they're poisoned by it. And that's a terrible tragedy for someone to understand. And science is woefully unprepared to answer that emotional question that comes out of that.
Well, with what you've learned and with what you've been doing here in the last year especially, is there any kind of words of wisdom that you might offer to those throughout the food chain who are feeling such a strong need, I guess you would say, to try to help bridge this divide between, you know, the production side of the agricultural business and the consumer who goes to their grocery store? What can we do today to try to help reach them, maybe at an emotional level, if we can't on a more commonsensical one?
Well, I'll preface that by saying there is no easy answer, obviously, or we wouldn't be having this debate, this discussion in the first place. But I think if I were to give one piece of advice, it would be that we have to learn to park our natural tendency to say, "Are you guys kidding me?" at the door. We have to learn to open our ears, open our minds, and open our hearts to what our critics are saying. And I'll give you a perfect example. This really jumped out to me recently. We were discussing animal rights. You know, do farmers have an ethical basis for using animals in food? And someone brought up the point that, well, if you discuss animal rights, don't you have to naturally discuss plant rights as well? Do plants have a right to not be used as food? And this was a room full of agribusiness types. And I think every person to a person in that room went, "Are you guys kidding?" You know, but the point I'm making is, until we begin to understand why someone raises that question, and then we understand the moral and the philosophical and the ethical underpinnings of why not only do plants not have rights, but I believe animals don't have rights. Until we understand those underpinnings, we can never effectively address the critics who are raising those issues. That's what we in agriculture need to do.
Yeah.
We need to go back to the other side of the universities. We need to go back to the philosophy departments and the ethics departments and the sociology departments. And we need to study. We need to learn the language and the thinking that our critics are using to criticize us. Until we do, we're not going to effectively address them. All we're going to do is deflect and diffuse and be disingenuous in our responses.
Well, I saw an interesting story or article yesterday through Facebook, of course, but it was about a, I think it was an Illinois Farm Bureau study in Chicago area, where they found that people overwhelmingly seemed to think that when they saw these seed corn signs on a field out, you know, which aren't really that far outside of the city, mm-hmm. that it means that they were a corporate farm, maybe owned by that corporation, you know, a Pioneer or a DeKalb or yeah. Crows. And it just kind of, you look at that and go, gosh, that's been an icon of the countryside, and all it means is that they're using that company's seed.
Right.
But look at what these consumers are thinking. And I think it's like a real eye-opener to go, okay, we maybe need to do a little more study on some of this stuff to realize there may be some things we really can do proactively to try to either mitigate or help foster better understanding.
Right. I agree. And I'm not arguing that we do away with science and scientific and economic responses. Not at all. I think we need not one or the other, but we need both. But I think my response to that study would be, what is the underlying reason why people object to corporate ownership of farms in the first place? That's where we need to get to in order to effectively respond to that concern.
Well, in the time that you've been doing this, how would you describe the kind of feedback you've received? Because I've got to believe, especially since you're on the web there, that you're getting this from all parties.
Right. There's sort of been two prongs of feedback. One is, I think people in production agriculture, people on, I'll say people on our side of the fence for shorthand, but those people have kind of... it's kind of been either I think they get it or they don't. I think those who love it, and then there's a few who look at things like, for example, the most recent story we just posted, which was an interview with an author named Mary Eberstadt, who in effect has theorized that as we have as society has reduced its moral judgment of sex and sexuality, it has at the same time increased its moral judgment regarding food. So, in effect, there's become a new puritanism surrounding food. And I think, I think there's probably a portion of the audience who looks at that and says, So. and then on the other side, the other prong, of course, as you alluded to, is people on the other side who in some cases, had an interesting response. The 10 reasons, for example, I think I got a lot of, you know, I was called everything from a propagandist to an idiot and a dork and a page shill and a big ag mouthpiece and even Glenn Beck. So... but in a way, we took that as a good response, because I feel like the depth of the response told us that we had hit a nerve with that story. And I think, again, we did it because we engaged the critics in their language and in their thinking and did our best to answer them on their grounds and their terms.
Yeah.
And I think, again, the depth of the response showed that we must have at least accomplished a part of that job.
Well, I think you have to. I like the word engage, because we do tend to, especially in the media side of things, or those with that kind of background, it come from a tradition of sending information out, sort of pushing it on somebody, as opposed to joining in conversation with them, which I think is what the whole social networking, social media revolution with the technology that's allowing it does.
Yeah.
'Cause, you know, you're allowing even your critics to have essentially a voice, if you will, which I think adds credibility to what you're doing. We try to do that too, by the way, but, you know, It's interesting reading some of the comments to your stories that are posted there, because I think you are taking, I don't want to say a more reasonable approach to trying to communicate, because I can see how some of the really hardcore Aggies out there, like you said, might look at this and go, you know, that's just not, it's not strong enough. We should just, it's either black and white. There is no gray, you know, when essentially there is some gray, and you got to understand why there is.
Yeah, I think that's the key point is you, I do believe there are right answers and wrong answers, but I think you hit it exactly right. You have to, we have to understand why the disagreement. That's key.
What looking ahead then? What are your plans for the future? I mean, you've been doing this long enough to maybe make some judgments for how that's going. How do you feel about that? And anything you might want to share as you look ahead?
Well, you know, when we started this, I think every editor has faced this, but I was afraid that the tank was going to run dry on this, that we would eventually run out of good material. And I'm happy to report that we are flooded with great ideas to cover every day in this arena, in this new arena of food and the social issues surrounding it. So we've got a lot of good stories to come. And, you know, I think one of the goals of the future, I hope, is to sort of try to bring back some of the good storytelling that I think is missing from agriculture today. And I think you might agree with this, being an ag journalist yourself, but if you look at the history of ag journalism, it was just filled with great storytellers. And I believe you can accomplish a lot with good storytelling. And I think we miss some of that element today in ag publishing, and I hope Truth in Food is one avenue to help bring some of that back to ag journalism.
Well, I hope so too, and I really do appreciate taking some time to speak with me here, Mike. We'll just remind people once again that you can find what Mike and Kevin and the folks are doing at truthinfood.com. I encourage you to go there and read some of these stories that we've been talking about, and hopefully gain a better understanding of or get some ideas for how you can communicate, whether it's your company or your farm or business, as we try to have a reasonable discussion about food today.
Good, and give us feedback. As you said, it's all about the dialogue. This is not a one-way discussion, so.
All right. Well, thanks again. That's Mike Smith, and we were talking about Truth in Food. Well, that is our Zimcast for this week, and I'm going to leave you with some music from Music Alley. And since we're talking about truth, this is a song called Truth of the Matter. It's by Drew Vix. I hope you enjoy it, and thank you for listening.
It's in your style. You look up at me and smile. It's in your way. It's something that simple words can't explain. It's in everything you said. It's in everything you did. And it's gone right to my head. The truth of the matter is, I'm doing the best I ever did. Makes all the difference in the world. Ever since I was a kid, I prayed that I would find the perfect girl. The truth of the matter is, I did. Now I must confess, I never thought I'd get out of that mess. You're partly to blame for turning the spark into this flame. It's in everything you said. It's in everything you did. And it's gone right to my head. The truth of the matter is, I'm doing the best I ever did. Being with you makes all the difference in the world. Ever since I was said I would find the perfect girl. The truth of the matter is, if you hold on to me and I hold on to you, look at all that we can be, look at all that we can do.
You've been listening to the Zimcast, the official podcast of AgWired. Check us out at www.agwired.com to find out what's new in agricultural marketing.